She just wanted to build, to learn, and then to build better. She didn't want to be the leader of anything more complicated than a finishing crew. But when politics well and truly came to the Mage Law, she was naturally at the centre of it, whether she wanted the honour or not. Thankfully, none of her immediate Wilderlord neighbours had taken issue with her rule, despite the large number of foreigners, particularly the Malcasalon, who had made Salik their second home. There were a few skirmishes over timbering and the usual arguments over frontiers, but no one was stupid enough to try to attack Carmella, keeper of Salik Tower. One look at her walking catapults was enough to dissuade any dissent to her rule.
"Each of those places needs more work," Sandy continued as he continued the tour. He showed me into Cormoran's private chambers, which were a mess. "Even the peeled towers, even Salik," he assured me. "They each need at least twice the garrison they have and walls 10 feet higher than they have. I'm trying to convince the local Wilderlords to consolidate their forces there, but they are resistant," he said, his eyes narrowing judgmentally.
"They can't afford to be resistant. There's a war coming. If we can spend a few weeks getting those castles provisioned and strengthened," I reasoned, "Shakathet will have to face them. I want to be in a position to attack from there, should he pass them by." Sandy threw back his head and groaned.
"We just spent a duke's ransom building perfectly good fortifications in the north. Why can't he be a good Nemavort and attack us there, where we've already went to the trouble?"
"They're pesky that way," I agreed. "Get a man under your command in each of those castles and towers to coordinate defences. Figure out how many men we can comfortably stuff into each of them, and make sure there are war magi and waystones at each castle. Now tell me about Varone," I prompted, before he could launch into 100 reasons why what I asked was too hard.
"Varone," he said, settling behind the topic. "Varone is actually pretty secure," Sandy admitted. "I was shocked, but Lord Stuart Kersal made civil defence a top priority. The walls around the town are in good repair and manned. A third of the garrison is now Al-Shari Third Commando veterans, and they are well armed and horsed. Most importantly, he's established a perimeter around Varone of fortified manors and fortlets to give a break and early warning of any intrusions, including on the road to Cleston," he chuckled.
"Well, I appreciate his thoroughness," I smiled. Cleston was the first town inside Castol, and fortifying the route meant that the Kersal took the threat of feudal war as seriously as the danger of goblins from the west. "Does that mean he anticipates any large armies from the east?"
"I let him know that there was a possibility," Sandy nodded grimly. "He appreciated the warning, and he understands his political role. Of that, I made certain. His loyalty is to Varone and Duke Anguin."
"Well, that's to be expected," I sighed. "Still, it's good to hear I won't have to run to Varone's defence, most likely. That would upset my plans."
"It would be helpful if we all knew what those plans were, Min," Sandy frowned.
"That would ruin the surprise," I smirked. "Enough people know enough about what they are so that you could put it together in my absence."
"That is not reassuring in the slightest," Sandy snapped.
"It will have to do," I shrugged. "You know more than most. Be happy about that."
"Do I appear happy?" Sandy asked.
"The problem is that we face not just a military struggle," I explained, "but a political one as well. And the two have an effect on each other. I have to bear that in mind when I scheme. And sometimes that means obscuring or even deceiving my own people when necessary. I apologize, but it's how it has to be for the plan to work.
Can you at least tell me what the goal is?" he complained. "It might be easier to bear my ignorance if I didn't feel we were careening into the abyss."
"Fair enough," I sighed. "As far as you're concerned, the immediate goal is to defend against Shakathet. The ultimate goal is to end the goblin threat in the Wilderlands for our lifetime." He considered, chewing his lip.
"That's a reasonable goal,"
he conceded with a sigh. I was surprised. "You don't think that's a crazy idea?"
"Min, I've seen you turn a shithole mountain village into the premier magelands in the world when you pissed on it. I was skeptical about Vanador at first, but it was a steady job. And now you've turned it into a nice place. If it doesn't get sacked, he added. If you told me you were going to turn Tal Alon into charging knights, I'd at least have to give you a chance to prove it. I chuckled. Don't tempt me. But I do think there's a very faint chance that I can accomplish that. The thing is, if I talk too much about the plan, it won't work, I explained, and too many people will try to talk me out of it. I trust you, Min, Sandy assured. It's just easier to work when I know what I'm really doing. Chapter 11. Matters Mighty and Trivial. She who tends to little things ensures the great hath room to prosper. Wilderland's Folk Saying, from the collection of Janik the Riche. As much as I wanted to continue to dwell upon the end of the world, the extinction of humanity on Kalador, the peril my new realm faced, the quiet inquiries from King Ashakal, the subtle treachery of the Alka Alon, the overt treachery of Prince Tavard, and the bleak future of a world beset by evils beyond my control, I didn't. My wife wouldn't let me. Her creamery, you see, was starting to receive the all-important first milk of spring, as the herds fed on the tender green shoots bursting forth from the muddy soil. The milk was highly prized, she assured me, daily, and the most exquisite care had to be taken to convert it into curds and begin the cheese-making process. Milk sister Dawnza was quite adamant about that, and that, apparently, was more important than the minor matters with which I was contending. I admit I was conflicted on the point. I felt responsible somehow for the ultimate failure or success of humanity on Kalador. She felt responsible for the production of the best possible cheese, and she felt that was of more immediate importance. Since this was the most animated and invested I'd seen her since my return from Olam Saheri, I was hesitant to bank her enthusiasm with a broader perspective. Every evening I was at Spellmonger's Hall in Spellgarden, I received a lecture on cheesemaking. Humidity, temperature, curdling agents, the intricacies of milking, proper aging and storage, and 100 other factors responsible for the production of a quality cheese. I listened until my ears threatened revolt and my eyelids demanded some respite from the endless sermon on dairy cow selection and beneficial molds. And then it hit me. This is what other people heard when I discussed thaumaturgy. Even when they might understand the basics, the minutiae of the art was incredibly boring. That gave me some solace, as I steeled myself against yet another discussion of the day's cheesemaking. Alia's tendency toward intense focus on the subject was a little disturbing, but I had to admit that it was also refreshingly human. All of us, I reflected, as my eyes glazed over while she discussed proper curd-cutting techniques over dinner, have a weakness to indulge in our professional passions, whether such a discussion was welcome or not. Once we become proficient at some art or craft, we feel compelled to display our mastery of the subject to reaffirm our passion for it. I indulged her. I'd fought too hard, and too many good men had died for me to cast aside her desperate attempt at reclaiming her humanity. As painful as it was, I shut up and nodded, and gave the appropriate responses to what she was saying as if I was even remotely interested in the outcome. It wasn't that I disliked cheese or its creation, it was that I had only the barest passing interest in it. Learning more than I wanted to about cheese was a testament to my devotion to my wife. But the distraction of fermenting curds also admirably kept me from plunging into melancholia over the fate of humanity on Kalador. There was something wholesome and human about Alia's near obsession with her work, though it had little bearing on anything but what we had for supper. She was as serious and committed to her industry as I was to mine. The consequences of her work were not vital. They had little impact beyond my household. They would not preserve a life or defeat our enemies. They would not prevent catastrophe or protect our lands. But they kept her grounded in our reality in a way not even magic could. I couldn't explain it, but I couldn't fault it either. The mixture of mighty matters with the seemingly trivial in my household soothed us both, I think. I took as much of an enthusiastic interest as I could, under the circumstances, and that kept me distracted from an existential crisis that was threatening to overwhelm me. And my interest kept Alia from giving up in her quest to find the perfect cheese for our manor. She knew I was paying attention to her and her efforts. She also knew, at least intellectually, the dangers I was facing on behalf of the Mage Law. She did not take that for granted, nor did she pretend that her matters were more important than mine. She merely took advantage of my indulgence, and when she was done reporting her efforts, she was happy to consult with me on my own matters. Not that she was particularly helpful. When the problems you face are more on the cosmic side than the agricultural, there's not much more the layman can offer the wizard than sympathy. I couldn't very well not tell my wife what was bothering me, but I spared her most of the details of my struggles, and I tried to keep our conversations as simple as possible. I took the sympathy. I needed it. It helped keep my melancholia at bay. That was important. As we were preparing to face Shakathet's legions, having a despondent spellmonger would not help our cause. I took some solace in the splendor of my vassals, the officers of my county. When I'd been given the Mage Law, I'd done my best to bring the finest wizards with me to defend it. Thankfully, I have a lot of loyal and not terribly bright friends whose personal weaknesses I'd exploited to enlist their aid. Their courage and ingenuity in the fight against Gajakatar had raised them from mere war magi to something akin to heroes in the minds of my people. It was inspiring to witness. If the battle against Gajakatar saw Terlaman as the hero, then the battle against Shakathet saw Sandoval as the Mage Lord most responsible for our defence. Terlaman had worked with Carmella extensively on the concentrated defences at Spellgate. Walls, ditches, and redoubts were the most effective against the hordes of Gajakatar. Against Shakathet, our armies would have to serve, and Sandy was the man responsible for building them. In the southern vales, there was no such easily defensible bottleneck. That was our clear weakness. The entrance to the Great Eastern Plateau encompassed two long, gentle rises, punctuated by a single cluster of highlands, thrust out over the vale below like the prow of a ship, or a plough in the dirt. There were many pathways that led from the fertile fields and woodlands of the Duns River Valley, but few remaining fortifications overlooking them. The best defence came from the presence of Anguin's Tower on the southern bank. But there was really nothing else keeping an army from climbing the paths up the hills to gain access to the plateau. Once we realised how likely it was that Shakathet's plan was to rush our defences to attack from the south, it was clear that this would be a far more widespread fight than last winter's battle. The avenues available to him comprised several miles, unlike the western entrance at Spellgate. We just didn't have time to establish permanent defences against our foe. That meant using men, not walls, to meet the enemy. And Sandoval was the officer in charge of those men. He left his new bride only a few weeks after his wedding and went to Anguin's Tower to oversee the defence, while thousands of his troops made the march across the plateau to join him. Sandy did not concentrate his attention solely on Anguin's Tower and the Dunn's Vales, of course. Once his position was strong enough, he directed the placement of the main companies of the Vanador Guard in other strongholds in the southwest. He consulted with Azar at Megalyn Castle and began planning the forward defences. That largely involved arranging for reinforcements there and at the other local castles, but it also involved overseeing the best places to bivouac our troops before the invasion. It was busy work, but a charge Sandy was well suited to. Just as Terlaman was adept at strategy, Sandy had a knack for working with his men, as opposed to just leading them. He understood armies, how they were put together, how they trained, how they functioned. He'd always been a good soldier, I knew from personal experience. I suspected some part of Sandy perversely enjoyed army life, a concept I found a bit horrid. But he was good at what he did. As the guardsmen marched south from Vanador, Sandy ordered them to tarry at Anguin's Tower a few days before he assigned them to some post along the plateau or out among the fortresses destined to stand against Shakathet's hordes. Some he deemed better for garrison duty, while others he assigned to field duty or some special task, according to their abilities.
Sandy understood how to size up a unit in the field and know their strengths, weaknesses, and where they would best fit into his plans. Personnel and material, as limited as they were, functioned as his palette as he sketched out a defense against Chakathet that was at once both profound in its resilience and flexible enough to respond to a very fluid situation. No one who'd seen the intelligence reports from Mavone thought that this would be a straightforward attack, as Gaja Katar had gifted us. The enemy's legions were large and diverse, and their potential avenues of attack were many. Nor could we count upon the advantages that had aided us in previous battles. That was brought home by Mavone at the War Council at Megalin in early spring. He was even more direct in his private briefings with me. Mavone had just provided him with fresh intelligence, and both were eager to share it with me, for entirely different reasons. Mavone wanted to prove how adept his intelligence was. Sandy wanted to show me how dire the situation was. "I just received this from one of my most capable ravens. I'm afraid we cannot depend upon the Gervani's traditional aversion to getting their furry feet wet to keep them at bay this time," Mavone reported sadly, as he spread out three parchment leaves covered with sketches. "At first, I thought they were details of some siege engine. We'd seen a lot of those. But upon closer inspection, I could see that this was no catapult." "It's a bridge," Sandy observed, "but it doesn't cross anything," he pointed out, confused. "It's a bridge designed to be stored within a Hoxter pocket," Mavone corrected. "Five sections, each 30 feet long and 20 wide, enough to carry their largest wains," he predicted. "They come apart at the supporting posts," he said, indicating tall structures that were the basis for the plan. "Each landing section is built wide to ensure a solid anchor on the bank. Sudden fortress, meet the instant bridge," he said, with an annoyed snort. "Well, that dramatically expands the number of places they can cross the wild water, among other rivers," Sandy said somberly. "That will require an entire restructuring of my troop placements. Thanks, Mavone," he said sarcastically. "Would you prefer not knowing?" the Gilmoran challenged. "This does complicate things," he admitted, "but knowing about it allows us to prepare to counter to it. Indeed, knowing that the enemy has this capability, we can assume they will deploy it to its best effect," he proposed. "That should provide a better means of predicting his movements." "There is that," conceded Sandy, frowning as he turned to look at the campaign map. "Well, we can be certain that he will come against Megalin," I suggested. "There is no stronger place betwixt Chakathet and Vanador. The only question is how many of his forces will he send against us, and from which direction?" "There are far, far more questions than that," Sandy disagreed. "I can think of a score off the top of my head, but yes, they will have to invest Megalin, else they will leave a powerful foe behind them as they advance. That does not preclude them attacking us with just enough force to keep us pinned, while the bulk of their armies march past and on toward Anguin's Tower," I pointed out, shaking my head, "or wherever their route takes them." "I know," Sandy snapped. "We will need an army of at least 10,000 to deter them, and that's just to slow them down. I have maybe 8,000 militia and guards to play with, to cover the entire Wildwater Vale," he complained. From there, the discussion devolved into moving markers around the map in an attempt to determine what the best response would be to a number of different scenarios. Things occasionally got heated, as the council argued over the capabilities of each unit. Sandy did seem to have the best idea of what we had available, and what we didn't, and I found myself backing his assessment more frequently. We were spread thin. We were fighting against a much larger force. This contest would be settled by how mobile and how deadly we could be. As good as Sandy and Mavone were at their jobs, Turlaman held the hearts of my folk like no other officer in the Mage Law. Since his triumphant victory at Spellgate, Turlaman had seen his status soar in Vanador. His stratagems and overwhelming victory during the winter campaign had branded his glory in the minds of one and all within Vanador's bounds. Though he'd been recognized for his importance by the military before the battle, he'd not enjoyed the kind of public recognition that was bestowed upon him afterward. Even more than Sandy, Turl had always been a soldier's soldier. When we were both kids just out of war college, Trudging down the impassable reaches of Faris, he'd been a stoic example of devotion to Warcraft, while our weaker colleagues succumbed to the tortuous dangers of that journey, or at least bitched to the heavens the entire way there. Terl understood warfare and armies like a whore knows cosmetics and flirtation. He was not just invested in the inspections and drills that most commanders use to value a warrior. Terl made a point of learning the arts of command, strategy, and tactics, and then employing them in his own missions. If Sandy understood soldiers, Terlaman understood war. His success was his credential. Patrols he accompanied came back largely intact. Positions he was sent to infiltrate were eliminated. When everyone else was collapsed around the fire at the end of the day's march, Terl would be sharpening his blade, tending his gear, and quizzing our commanders about the route ahead. We'd been through a lot since then. While I'd ended up dabbling in thaumaturgy and politics, Terl had remained steadfast at his craft whenever possible. The invasion, the Gilmoran campaigns, and the Battle of the Red Ice had nearly broken me, but they had tempered Terlaman like the hottest of fires. When the great Battle of Olum Saheri was launched, it was only natural that I turned to him to command. But after the Battle of Spellgate, Terlaman changed a bit. It wasn't just the victory, which was profound enough, but how he'd accomplished it. The greatest war magi in the world regularly touted his brilliance to one and all, and the common soldiers saw in him a dashing figure of quiet mastery. Those opinions quickly filtered down to the common folk, until the sight of the tall Marshal of Vanador regularly caused a respectful stir among the crowds in town. At first, I didn't think it had affected my old friend. He'd seen victory celebrations before, more than most commanders. But after Yule, there seemed a subtle change in how he responded to the acclaim he now enjoyed. He dressed more carefully, not like Astaroth's overindulged sense of style, nor did he use Azar's melodramatic sartorial choices. He began to wear a higher quality of cloth, and always in a military cut, and I noted that he was more conscious of the figure he struck when he travelled. He took more attention to how his beard and hair were cut by his barber. He began to carry an entourage too, comprised of his aides and apprentice squires, all of whom seemed to contend to be as superbly dashing as their master. That was helped by their propensity to be in armour at all times, the brightly polished, impossibly light Iltadine steel hauberks that our smithies were forging now. Terlaman spent his pay and his bonuses on the finest panoply his coin and influence could produce for his men. A half dozen knights in armour is impressive. The same party, dressed head-to-toe in burnished steel, lit by a flock of mage lights, was wondrous. Terlaman's social life likewise took a turn. Once a man who seemed determined to pursue a simple, solitary life, dining alone and living in sparse quarters, his newfound position and fame saw him holding forth many nights with his gentlemen at one of the many inns and taverns of Vanador, or within the chambers of distinguished hosts, myself included. I won't say it went to his head, because Terlaman just doesn't have the capacity for that kind of weakness or self-delusion. But there was a sense of proud security that developed around him like a mantle after the glories of Spellgate, and in some ways that translated to a new kind of confidence, bordering on arrogance. I wasn't complaining. Terlaman had yet to lose a battle. I wasn't eager to see the day when he did. While Sandy worked to cultivate and deploy his forces across the Mage Law, Terl quietly studied the maps and the reports, and tried to formulate a strategy against the coming assault. He was receiving the same dispatches and reports at Spellgate as I enjoyed at Spellgarden, but while I weighed each new account as a fresh threat to my realm, Terl saw them as just one more factor he needed to integrate into his plans. I wasn't much involved, apart from the occasional progress report. Terl relied heavily on his own staff, and I could not find much fault with their strategies. I approved the orders when they came to me. When Spellgate issued an order insisting some stronghold was more important than another, not only did it receive what reinforcement Terl recommended, it was frequently the beneficiary of a few wagon loads of additional supplies from Verone or Vanador. I wasn't second-guessing Terlaman, but I didn't want him scrimping unnecessarily on such an important front. In general, I was pleased with the progress. Thousands of men were marching south and west from Vanador.
Thousands more were taking training on the plateau to take their place, and enough were left to return to their farms and begin the ploughing and planting so that I didn't worry about starvation. But that didn't mean there weren't problems I had to get involved in. The most pressing was the proposed location of the new hospital, of all things. While troops were marching, and castles were preparing for siege, and tens of thousands were mobilizing for action, the matter that required my professional attention as a count the most was determining the location of the new permanent hospital Lelastian and the other physicians and surgeons insisted we needed. I wasn't convinced of the necessity. We'd lost more men to frostbite and dysentery than to war wounds after Gajakatar's winter attack, but Lelastian in particular insisted on the need for a larger, better facility to care for the wounded we anticipated would result from Shakathet's assault. I wasn't really arguing against it, but it didn't seem a priority. I told her so when she tracked me down at Spellgarden and insisted I address the issue. "It's not about the present need," Lelastian informed me. "We need to plan for the future. We have hundreds of patients now. This time next year, we'll have thousands," she predicted. "If we are alive at all," I pointed out. "It's my job to prepare for that unlikely possibility," she agreed dryly. "Look, Minolin, I appreciate the importance of dying gloriously in defense of your clan or country. Truly, I do," she said, with exaggerated agreeableness. "But I am charged with the care and recovery of those who don't manage that splendid destiny. As primitive as these conditions are, it is possible to manage at least minimal standards of care for the wounded," she reasoned. "Lelastian, I never gave you that responsibility," I reasoned. "Indeed, you were released into my care as an advisor in the war, not as a surgeon." "Silly mortal," she scoffed in that infuriating manner she adopted when she felt the need to demonstrate her longevity, age, and wisdom. "I didn't receive that charge from you. I got it from the Calidore Medical Association almost 700 years ago." "Surely you don't feel bound by that," I countered. "I took an oath," she declared, with more sincerity than I suspected she possessed. "A human oath, but an oath nonetheless. One of the most ancient oaths your people ever concocted, one that requires me to assist the injured and sick." "Which you are doing," I reasoned. "Not nearly well enough," she replied hotly. "Most of my patients are in tents or warehouses turned into infirmaries. The little clinic in Vanador is woefully insufficient for the work we have. What happens when I have 10 times the wounded?" she wondered. "We just aren't prepared for that." "And you don't get prepared for that at the last minute. If you want these men you're leading into battle to have a fighting chance to survive their wounds, you'll listen to me." "I am listening to you," I pointed out, quietly amused at how insistent she was being. "Then designate some patch of ground for this hospital now, and let me build it," she pleaded. "Let me train your people in how to treat your people, without relying overmuch on prayers and superstition," she added with a sneer. "Not that there isn't a place for that sort of thing. Min, I have precious few pieces of advanced medical equipment left over from the old days. Your people used to be able to..." "I don't even have the words," she confessed in exasperation. "Even I, the jaded Alka'alon spell singer, was impressed by what your folk did without the benefit of magic once upon a time. All of that is gone, but with Forseti and a chance to rebuild a little of it, I could make a real difference to the poor bastards you are marching to their doom. You've got some good people here, Ikurad, among others. I think I could teach them a lot," she proposed. I winced internally, but grinned to my friend. "I understand," I soothed, "and I'm sympathetic. I've actually looked at a few sites, in anticipation of this request. I've settled on the old hamlet of Henga," I proposed. "It's in the eastern end of the plateau, on the eaves of the Kulines. There are a few freeholders nearby, but the settlement was largely wiped out in the invasion. It's distant from the current war, near to Enasiatharel, and protected from casual assault." "Are there any facilities?" she asked hesitantly. "Precious few. An old keep. A few halls," I shrugged. "It will need a lot of work, but it's better than a few warehouses in Vanador. I'll designate a company of guards to garrison it, and I'll hire 100 to support it."
"That's...
That would be splendid, Minolin, she said graciously. I know it doesn't seem like much, but there is no real place for medicine in this world. Not the way your ancestors practiced it. If I can reintroduce just a tithe of that knowledge, thousands could be saved, or spared altogether. Good, I agreed, because I'm putting you in charge of Henga, not Ikarad. If you do possess the medical lore of our ancestors, then I want you to teach as many of our people as much of it as possible. I'm guessing that our command of the art has fallen in 700 years. Fallen? She snorted. It's completely disintegrated. You barely know how blood circulation works, and that's only because of magical observation. Same with the germ theory of disease. You people use leeches and herbs. You used to be able to regrow or reattach severed limbs. We've been busy surviving in a hostile world with dubious guidance, I offered. Our attention was elsewhere. Well, now that I'm free, it's back on good health and outstanding medicine, she insisted. Yes, I will take command of this Henga, and you will supply me with all that I need to teach your people how to care for your people. That's what I just said, I pointed out. I can do wonders if I have the proper tools, she said. It seemed as if she was trying to convince herself more than me. You'll have them, I agreed. I just told you that you would. We'll need to prevail on the Alka-Alon Council to release certain devices from the Hall of Memory, she continued, ignoring me. I've already gotten most of the obvious medical equipment out, but there are other things we could use, things that will be useful. And I will use my influence, such as it is, to acquire them, I agreed. She looked at me suspiciously. What are you playing at, Minolin? She asked accusingly. What? I've been nothing but helpful. I've agreed with your every demand, I pointed out defensively. Exactly. And after 700 years of dealing with your people, I've gotten to know when you're up to something, she accused, her eyes narrowing. I'm up to a lot of things, I countered. You're going to have to be more specific. This wouldn't have anything to do with the question before the council, would it? She asked, after a thoughtful pause. You mean the one about the end of magic, and likely all life on Kalador in 3,000 years? I asked casually. The one that your people have consciously omitted from our discussions over the centuries, or, if it did come up, the details were lost to history? The one which your folk seem strangely unconcerned by? I continued, my voice becoming slightly less casual and more intent as I spoke. How could the matter of a hospital have any bearing on that? I don't know, Lelastian admitted guiltily. Letheran and I advanced your question to the full council, who is considering it. We can do nothing until they decide, she declared. Buttering me up by letting me set up a clinic isn't going to do much. I already favor your case, and the council doesn't care a bit about whether or not humanity has decent medical care. Again, the two matters are entirely unrelated, I insisted, with a bit too much fervor. I certainly want humanity to have decent medical care. Is that not enough reason to authorize this? Not all acts are laden with ulterior motives, I lectured her. No, but that's usually the safe way to bet, she snapped back. I'll take the support, Minolin, but don't think I'm not watching you and wondering why you're doing it. I've gotten some hint of the quality of life our colonial ancestors enjoyed, I reasoned. We used to live to a century or more, and now most of us die before we're 40. Perhaps if we lived longer, we'd get more done, and get more respect from the immortals, I ventured. Don't count on it, she dismissed. Unless you live for at least half a millennium, you're just not particularly interesting individually. At least that's what the Vundle believe. By their standards, even the oldest Alka-Alon are as ephemeral as our servants. We barely hold their attention. I'm sure that must be very annoying for you, I said dryly. It also allows us to escape their notice in a lot of ways, she countered. That's been convenient. Not everything that my people has done would be approved by the Vundle. They tend to be conservative. Tell me, I said, a sudden thought occurring. Why did your people come to Kalador in the first place? That question took Lelastian by surprise, and I learned a lot from her expression. That happened so many years ago, longer than your own race took to drag itself out of the mud and aspire to the stars, she sighed. Why do you ask?
I asked Fossetti the same question of my people, hoping for some historical perspective. It occurred to me that it would be helpful if I got the same perspective from the Alka Alon.
The two are not dissimilar, she admitted, but that was in my ancestors' days. The accounts that we have of that time are sadly incomplete, or inaccurate, conflicting.
Spare me an epic, I suggested. Just a summary would be nice.
As I said, the two colonizations were not dissimilar. In each case, the homeworld was fatigued, worn by the rigors of civilization and plagued by war, strife, and natural catastrophe. The Alon colonization was perhaps more desperate, because our planet's own magisphere, which was far less potent and efficient than Kalidor's, was collapsing, along with our biosphere and our society. That meant that our ability to counter the damage was impaired. Some chose to stay and try to repair the damage, but others, my ancestors, sought refuge in the rest of the universe.
So who were these people? I asked conversationally. Were they all Alka Alon?
Not as you know us, she admitted. Physically, we were a bit different and adapted ourselves to Kalidor after we arrived. Compared to humanity, the Alon in general tend to evolve to fit our environment far more rapidly and easily. Traits that take 6 generations to take root in a human population can arise within 2 among the Alon. Magic helps, she lectured, crossing her white-sleeved arms over her chest. But that's part of our genetics, too, and one reason we left our homeworld. Without magic, we would have been far less able to adapt to new and dangerous conditions.
Not their physiology, although that is interesting, but who were they politically? What were their motivations? Were they sent by a desperate government? Were they missionaries? Cultists?
The Lastian grinned. A bit of all of them, the same as your people's colony. There were 5 main groups that came, each with their servant species. Once we arrived, however, things got chaotic. The original colonies in the east managed to maintain some of our original civilization, but once my people realized the incredible richness and potential of Kalidor, most departed from our original ways. Those early years saw a great divergence among the Alon, as the 5 kindreds spread out and were affected by the lands they took, and a great departure from the old ways and forms, as our society adapted too.
Which is why Korbal and the Enshadowed are so irritated, I recalled.
Yes, they were a particularly authoritarian faction, the Lastian said with a sneer, devoted traditionalists of a bad tradition, and they were particularly brutal about it too. But they were not the only ones who wanted to preserve the dead past on our new world. They were just more active about it and thus got exiled, and then repressed when they tried to start trouble out here in the hinterlands.
All right, I sighed. I appreciate your candor and your indulgence. I don't know what I was hoping to learn from her account, but there was no secret, incredible revelation that added to my understanding or contributed to an answer to any of my problems. I was a bit disappointed by that. It's nice when nearly immortal beings can slip you the answers to the hard questions, like Erencia presenting the sacred periodic tables to my ancestors. But it's also rare.
And I appreciate your curiosity, Minilin, she agreed pleasantly. The truth is, we were as much refugees as your folk, and in many ways, we were far less organized about our colonization. We had our share of explorers, researchers, adventurers and scoundrels when we came, people who wanted a fresh start on a new world with unlimited freedom. That wasn't always a good thing. We brought our prejudices, hatreds and insecurities with us, along with our happier motivations, just as your people did. We didn't leave behind war, strife or pettiness.
Fossetti says that my people were just seeking a viable world to settle upon, and that they actually desired the rural life, I said, making a face. I find it hard to believe that we crossed the void and risked our lives in order to be peasants. That made her laugh.
Actually, the version of rural life your ancestors had was highly idealized from the dirty reality.
They were largely an urban folk before they came. Indeed, they had to seek out farmers and horticulturalists from among them who actually knew how to farm and plant in order for the colony to be viable. Then her face clouded. But they were counting on the help of your marvellous machines, not the sweat of their own brow to bring in a crop. Unfortunately, some among my people saw that as a justification for allowing your civilization to decline after Perwin sank. Since your people wanted to have a closer relationship with the land, they theorized that forcing the survivors to leave their sophisticated lives on the island, to toil themselves in the vales of Merwin, a kind of assistance toward the colonists' original goal. In the process, they shortened your lifespans by half, she added condemningly, and they let the bulk of our civilization sink beneath the waves, I said, shaking my head. They had ample assistance from factions among your own people, she pointed out. You have to understand, Minilin, the politics back then were very different than now. There were those on both sides who presumed to know what was best for both species, and both governments were confronted with existential circumstances that forced unlikely alliances for completely different motivations. It was a chaotic time. Show me one that isn't, I sighed. That's why we're planning hospitals and castles and marching off to yet another pointless war. It's hard to imagine that, when our ancestors came here, just to struggle against each other so hard. It's in our nature, she agreed sadly. I suppose it doesn't matter where we wander in the universe. We're just looking for a bigger sand pit to play in. But the game is always the same. There was a moment of silence while we both contemplated the futility of civilization in the face of our inner nature, against the background of a universe that seemed determined to frustrate and kill us. Drink? I asked finally, pushing away my dark thoughts. A big one, Lelastian agreed. I just realized I'm going to be a hospital administrator again. Best I start the process now.
Chapter 12. The Riche in Spellgarden. The wise understand by themselves. The fools listen to the crowd. Wilderland's folk saying, from the collection of Janik the Riche. Master Janik joined me for the day at my invitation, and endured witnessing the spellmonger in his natural surrounds, performing my expected duties. Brother Bright grumbled about allowing such an intimate view of my business by a relative stranger and proven spy, but Janik can charm the gods themselves, it is said, and it didn't take long for the minstrel to soothe the lawyer. Indeed, by the end of the day they were engaging as old friends, both intrigued by the other's intellect. Having Janik around Spellgarden for a while served two purposes, allowing me to better examine a man who might be important to my rule, and allowing him the prerogative of bragging to my subjects about attending the count at his seat. That didn't preclude him speaking poorly of me, but he could not claim I was a stingy host. An added benefit was Janik's willingness to pick up his harp, lute, or his guitar, and burst into song or tell an insightful, amusing, or decidedly bawdy tale. By mid-morning, I could see just why the Riche were so valued by the Wilderlords. Janik began the day with a few light-hearted songs involving the children, the nuns, and even Alia in the hall, much to their enchantment. Then he and Bright accompanied me over to the keep for the day's business. Though it was still under construction, enough of the chambers had been completed to allow me to use it for work. Ordinarily, when a lord conducts his affairs, it is in a brightly lit solar where he can enjoy the comforts of the season, Janik remarked as he followed me up the stairs. My lord the count is at war, reminded Brother Bright behind him. It is fitting that he take his business in a castle. Your lord the count is a wizard at war, I corrected. As lovely as a comfy solar might be, much of my work is administrative or thaumaturgic, I explained, as I opened the door to the lower chamber. I work better indoors and unexposed. Sometimes even in caves, I admitted. And lighting is not really a problem, I reminded him as I waved my arms. A fleet of mage lights snapped into being across the high ceiling, bathing the entire chamber in bright light. That is helpful, Janik agreed, visibly impressed. It's warm in here, too, he observed. You can still see your breath outside. There's no fire laid, but the air in here is balmy. I left the heat stone on, I grimaced, nodding toward the disk of snowstone in the floor that served as such. I shouldn't, if there's no one here, but I forget sometimes. Make yourselves comfortable, I encouraged, as I made my way to my accustomed chair. It was a grand thing, not quite throne-like, but ornately carved. A gift from Carmella, from the finest Malka Salon craftsman. Eventually the tower will magically keep such wasteful things from happening, but I get distracted. Sometimes he'll get some idea in his head, slip into the Alka Alonways and disappear for hours. Brother Bright agreed. The next thing I know, I'm receiving a mirror message that he's in Verone or Castabriel or some other exotic place. It's disconcerting. I've no such plans for today, but I make no promises. What administrative matters require my attention, Brother Bright? I asked, without enthusiasm. I dislike that business the most, hence I dispense with it first. It's often the most important, I confided to Janik. And an excellent reason to slip away through the ways, agreed Brother Bright, as he removed a sheaf of parchment from his folio. Today's business is light, my lord. 7 military purchase and payment authorizations, 4 petitions, 5 mirror messages that came in the night, 4 requests for audiences, 2 pieces of correspondence, 1 rather long, some minor business for the manor, Mavone's daily intelligence report, and status reports from both Mage Lords Turlman and Sandoval from the field, he said from memory. Who is the correspondence from? I asked, as I prepared myself for the onslaught. The first and far longer missive is from Sire Kay, assuring you as to the health and security of your Barony of Sevendor, Bright explained. The second and shorter is from Count Anvaram of Neon, in Gilmora. Let's set them last in the list, then, I decided. I'll plough through the boring matters first. Would you care if I played while you worked, my lord? Janik inquired politely as he reached for his battered guitar. Just some instrumental pieces I'm working on. No singing, he promised. That would be delightful, Janik, I agreed with a sigh as the first parchment was placed in front of me. A little bureaucracy music, please. We made our way through the stack of matters relatively quickly, and while I would like to credit Janik's quiet, delightful playing, in truth it was due to Bright's equally masterful organizational skills. Every matter he brought to my attention he had reviewed and prepared a response in advance, sometimes several of them, in anticipation of my decisions. The appropriations were easy enough, of course, as I had ordered most of the expenditures myself and people needed to get paid. The petitions were also easily enough to decide, mostly whether to grant them immediately or push them off to my semi-annual courts. Janik just listened at first, and then started making the odd joke or commentary, which helped pass the time. It wasn't until I was at the final payment authorization that he made a face that invited comment. You object to strengthening the fortification of Iron Hill? I asked, surprised. Oh, no, my lord, Janik said, stopping his playing. Indeed, it seems as if you know your business well in regard to strategy. But Iron Hill Keep sits atop a maze of mines, sufficient to shelter half of the Vale. Iron Peg has hidden entrances to them all over her precious hill, including an old shaft that comes out nearly a quarter mile to the southwest. That's the one she doesn't want anyone knowing about, he said casually. Why is that? Asked Brother Bright, curious. Because it's her escape tunnel, for one thing, he informed us. Her grandsire had the shaft extended on purpose, to provide a quick exit should his creditors come knocking. But along the way they dug into a cavern, a big one. For 3 generations the family has secretly stocked it against, well, against something like the bloody goblin invasion, he admitted. It's huge and filled with rations and supplies. There's even a spring, and a room for her treasury, he added. It's an underground castle where the family can hide if their big fat fortress falls. They could hold out there for weeks, even months, but only a few know about it. But you do, I observed. The children of Riche have ridden the Northern Circuit for generations. We've picked up a few things along the way. It can be handy to know things about the Wilderlords that even the Wilderlords have forgotten. The secret castle of Iron Hill was known to us 50 years ago. It is House Faradine's most closely guarded secret. Iron Peg thinks no one else outside of the family is aware of it, though.
That is interesting, I agreed, my eyes narrowing. It would be well within your rights to inspect it, my lord, Brother Bright pointed out. If it is a storehouse or fortification, even underground, it is a military matter under your purview. The additional exit could be important too, I agreed, as I studied a mage map of the region. If a significant force could be concealed there, it changes the defensive dynamic of the battlefield. It likely isn't protected by magic, Janik replied. The Wilderfolk in general have been hesitant to employ wizards often, and were stingy with payment.
You're telling me, I snorted, recalling a year spent trying to sell my services as a freelance war mage here, before giving up and becoming a spellmonger instead. It seemed like a good idea at the time. But it would be easy enough for one of your wizards to accidentally discover it, Janik pointed out, as he began picking a melody on his instrument again. If he brought it to your attention, you would be forced to, and that would expose a potentially valuable installation to your knowledge.
I like the way this man thinks, my lord count, grinned Brother Bright.
Janik continued to offer his advice and perspective more readily after that. He made several small suggestions, most of which I took, as he quietly played nearby. By the time we got to the correspondence, an hour later, it almost seemed enjoyable. Almost. Sire Kay's long letter detailing the state of my lands and estates after the thankfully mild winter was welcomed and brought forth many happy memories of Sevendor, and not a little homesickness. As both my castellan and steward, he took great pains to elaborate the business he was attending with concise precision until I felt well informed about my barony. A few paragraphs toward the end included some less important notes about various personalities in the domain, as well as some news he felt I would appreciate.
Well, it seems that Olmeg and Lorcus are married, I said out loud to myself.
Two sisters. Witches, actually, I reported.
I'm afraid I don't know the gentleman, my lord, Brother Bright reminded me.
You will, someday, when my exile is done. My greenswarden and one of my vassals, both wizards of great power, and unequal temperament. Neither one was bound for matrimony, I'd thought. But look at me, I'm using news from home to distract me from Count Anvaram's inevitably threatening letter.
And it is indeed particularly threatening this time, my lord, Brother Bright agreed, as he rolled up Kay's report to be filed. The usual threats about returning his errant subjects, some dark muttering about the sequestration of Mage Lord Astoral's intended bride, and a livid passage proclaiming his dismay and anger at being taunted before his liege, the Duke of Castol, and his Royal Majesty.
Anything new? I asked dryly.
He says he's raising his banners, as his vassals are yet again urging him to defend the honour of the Gilmoran chivalry and punish the wicked sorcerer in the north.
Brother Bright said, with disdain.
As I invited him to do, I said, shaking my head. If he wants to lead his men hundreds of miles overland, through northern Gilmora and past the Pearwoods, that's his affair.
My lord, you taunt to Gilmoran Count? Janik asked, with interest.
He's insistent about forcibly repatriating the Gilmoran peasants who were enslaved and then liberated. As you are aware, the mage law is particularly specific about that, I reminded him.
I wrote that law, Brother Bright agreed, specifically because of demanding pricks like Anvaram. While I cannot officially encourage such uncivil behaviour, even for a valued client, I cannot slight Count Minolan for his choice of targets. Anvaram enjoys a reputation among the pompous asses of Gilmora as a pompous ass.
Are you willing to go to war against the Count to defend the Gilmoran peasants? Asked Janik, surprised.
Among other reasons, I shrugged. If he should stir himself and his dainty horsemen out of their comfortable estates, estates they were reluctant enough to defend when the Gavani invaded them, Then I will meet them in the field, I promised. I think the likelihood of that is low, I added. I like that, Janik said, with what I recognized as professional interest. I can use that. You're composing a song? Bright asked. I'm always composing songs, Janik dismissed. Sometimes they can be useful. Many of your folk still fear that they will be returned to Gilmora, despite your law. They place little faith in the word of the nobility, after generations of abuse by the Gilmoran aristocracy. A couple of verses set to a jaunty tune can help convince them that the spellmonger won't betray them. They're a damn sight more useful working toward for their own benefit here than toiling in the cotton and maize fields of Gilmora, I agreed. If you want to write a song about that, I encourage you to do so. It can be useful, I told Brother Bright, who looked skeptical. War magi do it all the time. Hells, Azar keeps a couple of minstrels on staff just to brag about how God's damn great he is. Amateurs, Janik dismissed as he strummed the discordant chord. After the matters of administration were dispensed with, it was time for a lunch appointment with my new arcanist, Heath. This was only my third such discussion with the man since I hired him, as I'd had various conferences, clandestine meetings, interrogations, plans and plots to conduct, but I liked to check in with Heath every week or so. Not just to hear what his research had revealed, but to keep him informed of what I knew. He, among only a very few, was cleared to hear the details of my most secret discoveries. Indeed, that earned me a look from Brother Bright, who had originally counseled me to be wary of telling too many secrets to too many people when Heath first took my service. But he seemed even more concerned about Janik's presence. I dismissed his concerns with a silent look of my own. Brother Bright couldn't communicate mind to mind, but he is nearly as subtle as a wizard. With a small sigh, he accepted my decision to include Janik in my secret councils, despite his silent objection. I was his boss. It was my job to screw things up, after all. Heath transported himself through the ways right on time, coming out through the waypoint I'd installed for that purpose directly into my chambers. He grinned after suppressing his nausea. He still found the means of travel novel. He bowed respectfully to me and both men before taking a seat. Ruderal fetched us wine as I filled him in on a number of developments, including the interrogation of Kudoz, the proposed advances of Shakathet, the situation with Anvaram, the discovery of the death of magic in the world, and the comparative differences between the Alka-Alon colonization and humanity's own. Heath and I spoke casually of such things, and it became increasingly apparent that Janik was surprised, shocked, and even skeptical of some of the matters we discussed. This wasn't idle gossip of Iron Peg's secrets. These were matters of history and law, largely outside of his knowledge. Discussing how irritated I was with the vaunted Alka-Alon Council, or how depressed I was about something that wouldn't happen for 3 millennia, seemed to bewilder the minstrel. As for Heath's part, he had been busy. Heath had taken his new task as my arcanist with a particular passion. Flitting between the Enchanter's Quarter and the Thaumaturge's Quarter, Sevendor, the Tower of Sorcery, and even the Citadel of Wenchar, Heath had begun to gather a substantial store of lore for the shelves of the Arcanium. Not all of it was magical in nature. Indeed, most of it was natural history and obscure religious texts, entirely unrelated to magic as such. But once I'd outlined the expectations of the various projects, Heath seemed to know which text needed to be acquired, either as an original or a copy, and where to find it. He wasn't quite a librarian. He was far more purposeful in his acquisitions, and he made a point to read many of them personally. He'd quickly hired a staff of researchers to delve more deeply and completely into particular works, but he made a point to be aware of the progress of their research through regular consultation. It was a daunting task. I'd given him the mission to unravel the tangled fabric of our imperfectly recorded history and sift out a few important details, and then provide enough historic context to understand those details. It didn't help that I had no clear idea what exactly he was looking for. Something about the Forsaken, the Vundel, the Alka-Alon, Lost Perwin, the lands beyond the Shallow Sea. I wanted it all,
properly prepared and seasoned with context to make it palatable. Gods forbid someone ask him about the details of his work. Heath was eager to share the minutiae of his searching, from the minor triumphs in acquiring some obscure monk's theological ruminations on the stars, to his failure to determine the importance of the cargo manifests from the last voyages from Perwin. He'd not only expound on the material, without pausing for breath, but would also relate, in equal detail, the method of his acquisition and the characters he'd encountered in doing so. Meetings with Heath often took a long time. I'd quickly impressed upon him the importance of my time, and he didn't take it personally. He was able to be succinct at need. I understood that attention to detail was the particular talent of an arcanist, but Heath also understood my role as his patron. I had questions, and I needed answers. I didn't need to know how he got them. If I had questions, I asked. Nor did I discourage him chasing down some unlikely avenues of research, as expensive as it was. He'd spent 3 days prowling the libraries of Castabriel's temple district, and he even travelled to a temple beyond the city's walls, in search of a reference he suspected might direct him toward an early account of a legendary series of voyages in the late Majocracy that may or may not have ever happened. I trusted his judgment. I had to. But I also kept watch on where his judgment might lead. We had organized his endeavors into 3 broad categories, the Vundle, the Forsaken, and Snowstone. There were other portfolios he pursued, but those 3 were of prime importance and took up most of his energies. If a professional arcanist seeks the occult and obscure, I had handed him 3 of the most hidden challenges in history. Despite Brigger's urging, I did not expect Heath's efforts to bear fruit quickly. I knew, as a fact, that there was little in the records and archives about the first 2 projects, and the Thaumaturgists' Guild had proven that very little existed about Snowstone and its effects before I had produced it. It wasn't quite a hopeless quest, but it would do until a real one came by. But that's why I had an arcanist. Despite the difficulty of the task, Heath's enthusiastic pursuit began to produce some small results and some good leads toward other resources. He had found a detailed account of the Vundle's legendary history in the annals of the Tower of Sorcery, supposedly written during the colonization. Some of the information was intriguing, once you figured out what the old Perwanese was actually saying. Was it directly helpful? I didn't know. On the matter of the Forsaken, he continued enthusiastically, there is no doubt that when the ancient accounts are read with the knowledge of the true nature of the new horizon, it gives one a far different understanding of the account. Passages that have long been obscure suddenly make sense. For example, this one from the Chronicles of Perwin states, the might of the horizon was uncontested. The captains of the sky dwelt vigilantly there, and by employing Kalsat as their eyes, oversaw the peace of Perwin against the dangers of Kalador for generations. We've always taken this as allegory, he explained. After all, the great eagle of Orvatus saw all, according to legend, and it was assumed that these captains of the skies were his lieutenants, servants or minions, in his palace at the horizon. Orvatus isn't even mentioned in the Chronicles until 80 years after the inundation. But if the horizon was a skyship, and not a mythical palace, I reasoned, and Kalsat was a series of wizard eyes, instead of a giant supernatural eagle, then it does show us something about the history, that our ancestors continued to guard us from the skies for years after the colonization of Perwin. Oh, more than that, Heath agreed, pulling a scroll from his bundle. Later in the Chronicle, there's an entire passage detailing the might of the captains of the sky. They had ships of the air, great engines of war that could lay waste to the entire countryside, if I read this correctly. There was a kind of army, or at least a force of warriors, that watched from the horizon. The account says that they were on guard against a possible struggle with the Alon, or a betrayal of the Vundle. They thought they could contend with the Vundle,
I asked, surprised. Are they not more powerful than the Alcaalon, from what you have told me? Brother Bright asked, confused. Many times as powerful, I agreed gravely. I wouldn't think our ancestors, despite their tekka, would have the means to threaten them. It was a matter that was apparently discussed, Heath assured. Perhaps their weapons were not enough to conquer the sea folk, but they were confident in their ability to attack and cause them some harm. But they were also wary of the consequences of challenging such a power. How could they possibly challenge the Vandal? I asked, skeptically. They were possessed of some great forces, powerful enough for them to cross the void, Heath reminded me. Their intelligences were constantly watching for any signs of danger, but it seems that they were reluctant to consider striking, despite their supposedly warlike nature. It was understood as a suicidal endeavour, only to be considered in the direst of emergencies. The same with the Alcaalon, he continued, scanning his notes. A conflict with them was considered more likely, and therefore more prepared for by the Cold Deaf Captains, as they were known. Short for Colonial Defence, I supplied. Fossetti explained that to me. The armed force that was pledged to protect our ancestors. There was a base of them at Novaminos, if I recall correctly. One of the last places evacuated during the inundation. Yes, and the Cold Deaf Captain of Novaminos withdrew his men from the affairs of the Empire and sought a kingdom in the East, Heath quoted from memory. Indeed, the Captain of Novaminos was the first to advocate to recall the Forsaken, he pointed out. When the Mage Lords of Perwin declined, he withdrew his navy and said he would seek to recall them on his own. He didn't, I pointed out. Why not? That's a good question, Heath admitted, scribbling a note on his scroll. History doesn't record it, to my knowledge. Perhaps he was overcome by a storm? That seems to happen a lot to navies in the shallow sea. I was under the impression he founded some kingdom beyond the sea to the east, I suggested. We know precious little about those places. They're hard to get to, apparently. You have to cross the Great Reefs, and the Vandal don't like mariners doing it much, which is why it's both dangerous and lucrative, he admitted. But it's assumed from the texts that only the Captain of Novaminos and the King of Unstara had the power to recall the Forsaken after their exile. Both on the other side of the sea, I shrugged. That's not terribly helpful. Oh, you never know, Heath countered, looking up sharply. Sometimes some obscure tidbit of information can lead to all sorts of interesting things. I'll keep exploring and keep you informed. The good news involves the Snowstone Project from the Thaumaturgy Institute, he continued, as he rolled up the scroll and put it away. Master Theroniel and his Senecal have a working theory about the underlying mechanism of the transformation. The bad news is that it's a quantum matter, he said, frowning. Quantum? Asked Janik, noting the importance of the word. Brother Bright also looked curious, and a bit grateful that the minstrel had asked the question. When you examine the world with mage sight, Heath explained, it tends to work along one set of rules, until you look at things so small that those rules no longer apply anymore. Another set of rules applies, a much different and stranger set of rules. At the very smallest scale, it's as if you enter a new universe, I agreed solemnly. One that is damnably hard to fathom, even with the knowledge magic grants you. Unfortunately, at its most basic level, that is where magic dwells. Heath eagerly took the opportunity to expound on this difficult-to-understand part of thaumaturgy. I had to admit, he did better than my instructor at the academy had done. The magical effects that you see with your eyes and other senses are the result of arcane forces, directed by consciousness, acting at these levels, you see, behaving in utterly incomprehensible ways, governed by rules of nature that are only barely understood by the wisest of us, he explained. The simplest mage light, he said, producing one eagerly, the way all wizards behave after they've received their witchstone, is a simple spell, but it requires a conscious flow of directed arcane power through a quantum mechanism that we don't understand, We just know how to use it, he said, extinguishing the light. Janik frowned and rubbed his chin in contemplation. So, you use magic, but you don't understand how it works.
You eat eggs, but you don't know how a chicken works,
considered Brother Bright.
Most laymen don't understand how the law works, or judicial process, but they still utilize it, he proposed.
I made a face. Perhaps that's an oversimplification of the metaphor. Like most phenomena in the universe, we observe, theorize, and then test those theories through experimentation, I tried to explain. That's the very basis for all science, including thaumaturgy. But with the quantum realm, where the essential forces of nature control all of the universe, the presence of the observer himself affects the outcome and direction of forces, as does the inclination of the observer, some experiments suggest, and a number of other theories.
Yes, quantum-level thaumaturgy is dependent upon the role of the observer in some cases, as well as their intent, Heath agreed. Multiple observers of the same phenomenon can further alter the outcome. Thankfully, that usually happens in fairly predictable ways, but not always.
So, you're saying that magic flows through the quantum universe one way, when no one is looking, but as soon as you begin to look, it behaves differently? Janik asked, confused. That doesn't make any sense.
Now you have mastered the subtle essence of quantum thaumaturgy, I agreed dryly, and why madness can be an occupational hazard for my profession.
We may not understand it, any more than a mariner understands why the ocean is down and the sky is up, but like that mariner, we can use what we do know about it to achieve the desired effect.
All this is terribly fascinating conjecture, my lords, Brother Bright lied unconvincingly, but I don't see how it affects our plans, unless I'm not supposed to see it, because that would alter it, he quipped.
If Master Theronio's Thaumaturgy Senecal has a working theory on snowstone creation, it is, I assured him. That's one of my more immediate concerns.
You have the details? I asked my arcanist eagerly.
Of course. Tarrant knew you'd want the specifics, so he drew up a report, Heath agreed, taking a thick scroll out of his satchel.
A very technical report, he added, as he glanced at the two laymen in the room.
We'll just be over here playing with our instruments, Janik assured us with a sigh. Don't mind us, witless peasants.
Brother Bright nodded sympathetically and then poured them each another glass of wine. Then Heath presented me with the most technically advanced thaumaturgical paper I had ever read. The Thaumaturgical College had cobbled together several existing theories about quantum-level magic, I saw, a few of them quite obscure. But then that field of study was obscure by nature. Reducing reality to the interplay of matter, energy, consciousness, and perception in a meaningful way required a special set of symbology, one I was only mildly familiar with. The concepts involved made other spellwork seem elementary and derivative by comparison, and several times I had to stop and recall a reference to remember just what in Six Hells a particular symbol meant. Few thaumaturges are comfortable with the arcane nature of the quantum world. Perhaps the brightest of them was Arnott of Merwin, whose patron was Archmage Randall I, about 500 years ago. He's the one who standardized the symbolic notation for the study, which is why it's called Arnottic notation. It is interesting to note that Arnott ended his career at the end of a rope after going mad and hanging himself. But the symbols he'd left behind allowed his followers to at least talk about the strange effects and relationships between elements and forces in the quantum realm, and that was useful. That was important, as the quantum realm was in fact responsible for many arcane effects, from the mage light Heath had conjured to the sympathy stones that comprised the magical mirror array that was increasingly filling my days with parchment work. We didn't understand much about it, but like the symbols that described it, it was useful. Taran's elegant explanation of their theory incorporated a lot of important elements, including divine magical force, elemental magical force, etheric density, dimensional instability due to lensing effects, three different types of intensive purpose, a particularly difficult sort of thing to describe in a few symbols, and no less than 7 impressive formulas that may, or may not, describe the method of action for reaching the production of snowstone. Heath and I discussed it for most of an hour. It was an elegant general theory, backed up by the sinister experiments of Dunsellin and Isserly, but it had problems. Mostly the sheer number of unknowns involved. While that's fairly standard for quantum thaumaturgy, in this case, any of those unknown factors could play a role in the outcome. Indeed, some of them had to, otherwise Dunsellin would have produced snowstone like I had. As impressive as Taran's report was, it was not the answer to the problem. It merely suggested a reasonable way to state the problem for further study. It would be helpful if we knew more about divine magic, what it does and how to quantify it, he concluded with a sigh. It's progress, I finally admitted, as my mind tried on each of the 7 potential answers. Tell them to keep at it. I'm encouraged by their results so far, I instructed Heath. They seemed pretty excited about it, agreed the arcanist as he rolled the scroll back up. They're working on a series of experimental models now, he added. Taran thinks he can work out the basics of the theory in a standard laboratory before he will require something more specialized. Once Heath left, Brother Bright and Janik rejoined me at the table. My lord, I have heard many foreign languages, the minstrel declared. I have heard plenty of discussion about subjects I knew nothing about, but never have I felt so ignorant as when overhearing your conversation about whatever the hell you were speaking of. It's merely a technical part of a technical field, I demurred, but I assure you it has importance. Thus, I have learned, Janik sighed. Indeed, today has been full of wisdom for me. I now know that the spellmonger contends not just with the Givani and the Nemovorti and all the villainous powers of 9 hells, but that he fences with the Alka alone and plunges headfirst into the deep and murky pool of ancient history, seeking for wisdom to secure a distant future, the bard declared, as he began picking a tune on his guitar. He scorns the men who would enslave the people while fighting a war to protect them from worse fates than a humble estate. A mind of deep subtlety, a heart filled with care and compassion, and a will unchallenged by the inconvenient facts of reality, he said in sonorous tones. Let's not inflate his ego more than necessary, shall we? Brother Bright sighed, rolling his eyes. I do have to work with the men. I'm not likely to be swayed by a pretty song about how brilliant I am, I chuckled. It's not his ego I seek to fortify, Janik dismissed. Indeed, this is not about Count Minolin at all. This is about the Wilderfolk, old and new, living in a dangerous, exciting time, filled with insecurities, hopes, and terrors. They are a new people in an old land, led by a mysterious wizard and faced by threats on all frontiers. When the Givani came, they were nearly abandoned by the Duke, if it hadn't been for the spellmonger. He broke the invasion at Timberwatch by compelling both dukes to fight together against it. He built the towers in the east that promised freedom and security. He restored the rightful Duke to rule over the entire duchy. He fought the dragons at Verone and Castabriel. He has brought them wonders and glories, and been a symbol of hope for years now. That's what I'm seeking to fortify, he continued firmly. This is not about aggrandizing my lord the Count. This is about giving my people the mantle of security, being led by a wise man who understands their fears and seeks to counter them. That seems a bold stance to take in front of your patron, suggested Brother Bright. The Rish have no permanent patrons, countered Janik, merely permanent interests. That's what separates us from common minstrels. I always thought that was a silly rule, back when the fair veil drew us back. Everyone likes an easy-to-flatter patron with a large purse. Now I understand it better, he admitted, his fingers plucking a compelling tune. The fact that Master Minolin is so involved with the affairs of the greater world, while dedicating himself to the especial protection and development of the Mage Law and its subjects, that is a worthy subject for song, he assured. And a song will help his rule, reasoned Brother Bright, skeptically. That is not my concern, dismissed Janik. My concern is for the well-being of those subjects.
They worry that you will be a tyrant some day, or worse, incompetent. You've brought many new rules and laws into their lives, and that change makes folk anxious. But you undertake the responsibility not for the glory of war or the appeal of a title and position, but because it is your God's damned job, he insisted. After today, I can truly report to my listeners, with all due sincerity, that the spellmonger is not only a great warrior and a powerful wizard, but that while he pursues his foes and elevates his subjects, he also devotes himself to mysteries undreamt of by even other wizards, explained Janik. Even the Alka Alon and the Sea Folk respect his intellect. Well, that might be stretching the truth a bit, I grumbled. They're peasants, reasoned Janik, stopping his playing for another sip of wine. What do they know? It will make them feel better. That's my God's damn job. Chapter 13. The Hidden Castle of Iron Hill. Every house in the Wilderlands has its secrets, from the smallest to the grandest. Wilderlands Folk Saying, from the collection of Janik the Riche. You realize that you sent me to observe a bunch of talentless amateurs pretending to understand poetry, don't you? Janik accused as he burst into my office. I spent 8 days being charming and listening to some of the worst verse in Narasi history, he complained bitterly. Half-literate hermits who think rhyme and meter are tame pets to be doted upon and who think a god's damn mushroom exploding into its fungal glory is somehow a worthy metaphor for...